Owning a small business can be overwhelming. How can your business stand out and connect with customers? Easy. Get Constant Contact. There's so many places to reach customers. Email, text messages, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, live events. The list goes on. How are you, as the business owner, expected to own all of those channels? That's where Constant Contact comes in to help. With Constant Contact, you'll reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and communicate more effectively to sell more, raise more, and fast-track growth. I use this to grow my email list, and you should too. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
From your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis and Josh Nelson.
And welcome to a new Sox Machine Live. I am your host, Josh Nelson, alongside Jim Margulis, the managing editor of SoxMachine.com. It is late Thursday night, 7 p.m. Central Time on October 26th. We have a World Series matchup. Just like everyone predicted, it's the Texas Rangers against the Arizona Diamondbacks in the Fall Classic. Kidding, of course. But it is one of our favorite times of the year, even though Jim and I would rather talk about the White Sox playing in the World Series. No, it is the off-season plan project. When you're coming off a 101-loss season, everybody wants to rinse this bad taste out of their mouth. And here we are giving everyone the opportunity to act as the general manager of the Chicago White Sox, to be in Chris Getz's shoes and run their own off-season plan. And Jim, this is always a very fun exercise, but I feel coming into this off-season, like the last two off-seasons have been about try to build a playoff team. This particular off-season plan project, I think, can go in a variety of directions.
That's been the most difficult part of trying to set the template, the expectations for what people might want to build and the budget number that goes along with that. Because, like you said, the objectives were very clear the last 2 years, last 3 years, in fact, of just building a postseason team. Had a rough idea of what the payroll limit might be. And sure enough, like both of the last 2 years, I set the payroll limit at 190 million. And they came in at, I think, like 193 and 183. So basically around that number, give or take, like mid-grade reliever, which Rick Hahn inevitably signed. This time around, it's like, well, you know, I could set the level one thing, but people might come in 40, 50 million under if they think like there's no way of really making a contender out of this team. It's more about like trying to insulate the prospects who are going to be ready or might be ready at the end of the year or at the beginning of next year. And just how do you get by? How do you present like a team that's professional, but also, not worry about, not saddle them with the expectations that basically were ruined last year. So should be a really interesting exercise. Some people will say it won't be fun because you're not shaping a contender this year and you're not really, there will be probably some people who might be able to figure out how to make like a team that can contend if everybody hits their 70th percentile outcomes. That's within reach. So I think it's kind of a litmus test for how optimistic individual fans are as they go out figuring just exactly what kind of roster they want to present.
That's a good point about the litmus test and how White Sox fans feel, if it's even worthwhile. Obviously, the very first comment during the live stream, as we are streaming this live on youtube.com/SoxMachine, is it's not worth it as long as Jerry Reinsdorf's in charge.
Shut up.
And Clutch Hat also put this comment in the YouTube stream. I don't see how you can make a contender realistically. And I guess with this particular World Series matchup, this is where, I don't know if it's like fool's hope, Jim, but just 2 years ago, the Texas Rangers and the Arizona Diamondbacks both lost 100-plus games. Both franchises went in different ways of rebuilding as far as their team into a contender. The Texas Rangers spent a lot of money. The Arizona Diamondbacks completely changed on the type of players that they drafted and that they signed, even on the international front as well. and the 84-win Diamondbacks and the 90-win Texas Rangers, the fifth seed in the American League and the sixth seed in the National League, are to face each other in the World Series because variance is awesome and chaos can be fun. And that's what we've got this year in the MLB postseason. Anything can happen in the postseason. You just got to get there, but it's a matter of how you get there. And I think the model has been proven lately. Yes, you do need to have a strong pipeline. You need to have a strong backbone, but you also have to spend premium dollars on premium players in free agency. That is still important. And I think with this particular offseason plan project, if you are trying to build a contender, this is where I'm going to be curious on like what kind of premium free agents that White Sox fans would want the team to go after. On the position player front, if you've listened to our review podcasts, there's not a whole lot going on in free agency this year. There's plenty of options, though, on the starting pitching front. So if you want to enhance the position player front, trades are going to have to come up if you are looking for that premium talent. And I can't wait to see what people have as far as trades with this coming offseason plan project. With that said, this episode is to help you, those that are participating in the offseason plan project, or those that just enjoy reading everyone's plans for this upcoming offseason, to walk you through step-by-step through the process. But before we get started, I thought it'd be kind of fun to take a look at my offseason plan last year for this upcoming season, Jim. I wasn't too busy. I did have a trade sending Liam Hendricks to the Los Angeles Dodgers. That was before we found out that he had cancer. One of the players that I had mocked returning to the White Sox was actually Nick Destrini. And I totally forgot that I wrote about that until I read it this morning while I was preparing for this show. And yay me, thumbs up. That actually kind of not directly happened. And now Nick Destrini is on the Chicago White Sox, but there's a big decision to be made about Liam Hendricks. But I really zeroed in on like three players in my offseason plan project to try to make an 81-win team into like an 85, 86-win team. And the White Sox this year didn't come close to that. And there was a good move by me, there was a meh, and there was a really bad move. So my plan last year, the good, trading for Anthony Santander, that would have been a great move for the White Sox because he's the type of bat that they needed in the lineup. He was a 3-WAR player, according to BaseballReference.com. He had 28 homers for the Orioles this year, almost drove in 100 RBIs. He finished at 95. His OPS plus was 121, which would have easily been second on the White Sox. And he had 257 with a 325 on-base percentage. That's not a high on-base percentage, but he slugged 472. That's the type of hitter the White Sox needed to bat behind Luis Robert Jr. So I'm going to count that as that was a good idea, Josh. My meh idea was signing Sean Manaea, the left-handed pitcher. And funny, he went to the San Francisco Giants on a 2-year deal, Jim, when Brian Bannister's there. And they kind of used him in this hybrid role this year. He appeared in 37 games. He made 10 starts. He pitched 117 innings. And he was hovering around league average. His ERA plus finished at 95, so he ended up being 5% below league average. He had a 4.44 ERA. His WAR was 0.3 for the season. If he was on the White Sox instead of the San Francisco Giants right now, Sean Manaea would have a very good chance of being a starting pitcher because the White Sox need help there. I'm going to call that a meh type of idea. The bad was signing Colton Juan to take care of second base. I don't know what happened to Colton Juan, Jim. He might be toast now at this stage of his career. 47 OPS plus. He just cannot hit in the majors anymore, and I don't think he's a viable major leaguer. So it's always fun to kind of take a look back to see on what I had thought of last year for the offseason plan project. And you know what? I'll take one out of three. That's a 333 batting average that works in baseball. I'll take it. At least I had one good idea.
It feels like a 1.5. Like Manaea would have helped in one regard or another. Like Mike Clevinger was better, although you don't have the headaches up front that Clevinger presented. But the White Sox could have used that given all the pitching problems they had elsewhere, that they would have been happy to have like Manaea in Jesse Schulten's place. So I'd give that like a half point.
Okay, you know what? I'll take it. I'll take 1.5 out of 3. The Colton Wong was just so bad. He was even worse than what the White Sox had. That would have just compounded problems. So, again, hey, if you can't make fun of yourself, you really can't make fun of anyone else. So it's always nice to go back to seeing how big of an idiot I was.
Yeah, I mean, you had a lot of I'm looking right now at one of the members of the Sox Machine community, Deja Vu. He has a Shop Talk post that I have ready to go for the morning, just reviewing the most popular candidates that people wanted signed or traded for or players traded away. And Colton Wong was number 3, you know, behind Jose Quintana and Michael Conforto. And like Quintana was okay when he's healthy. He just had that rib problem that, you know, I'm not sure if that's a, he might have had that regardless. Conforto was mediocre. Rodon was right behind Wong and terrible. So like Brandon Nimmo was my guy and he was good. Like he was what I thought the White Sox could use. But Manaea, number 6, Benintendi, number 7. So like, yeah, it was a case of just kind of a lottery, a potluck of players the White Sox can afford. And when they shop in that tier, you know, it's hard to get hits in their regard. So yeah, Santander was number 3 among the players most popular in trades behind Pepiot and Gavin Lux, who did not play. Pepiot was good. Santander was, number 3. Brandon Lau, number 5. He was good. So like Luzardo, number 6. So the trade targets were pretty good, up and down. Like Michael Bush didn't get much playing time. Like he's the only one who was below average of the guys who were healthy enough to play. So like the trade targets, generally speaking, the Sox Machine community did pretty well.
Yeah, the free agent, it's tough because you want to try to be realistic when working this offseason plan project. Because if you go in there like the White Sox are to sign Shohei Ohtani, like I'd love to see what everybody thinks, what kind of contract that they would offer to Ohtani that they think Ohtani would actually accept, because the whole Tommy John surgery is making things really hazy as far as his market. And I could see teams being hesitant to offering so many years up front. I could see a player mutual or club option within the first 2 years of that contract. If he can't pitch, teams are not going to want to pay him $50 million a year to be a DH. They're just not. No matter how good he is, teams are not going to want to pay that. So again, but back to the realistic part. I mean, Jerry Reinsdorf made it pretty clear. He's not going to be interested in signing Shohei Ohtani, which kind of sucks as a White Sox fan. So I could see where we just like miss as a community on free agents, because we're trying to shop and trying to shop where the White Sox are going to shop and try to think like how the White Sox front office would be. In the Target $1 bin, it's the first aisle that you run into at Target. And yeah, it's not a lot of fun. And it is, there's a lot more misses than hits. And that's why typically when it comes to the best players that hit free agency, that's why you got to spend a lot of money, because they earn it and they deserve it. And when you have cash like the Texas Rangers owner throws down, you can quickly turn the fate around of your organization. And if you don't want to spend that money, you better develop like the Arizona Diamondbacks and the Tampa Bay Rays and et cetera, of the mid to small market teams that are consistently good. Either way, the White Sox have a lot of work to do. So that was pokey fun at my plan last year. And if you guys want to go back to see your plans, you could do that. We have it archived on SoxMachine.com. Now it's time to go to the exercise. And we will start with the tender or non-tender. Now, within 10 days of the World Series ending is the deadline for Chris Getz to make some moves. And we're going to break those down right away. So the first decision, Jim, is Liam Hendricks. The club option is $15 million, or it's this buyout that we've been talking about ever since he signed the contract with the White Sox, $1.5 million over the next 10 years. And again, Hendricks, Tommy John surgery, he is out until at least August. He thinks he could come back in August, but again, you have to be careful with everything that he has gone through as far as his body, beating cancer, came back from that, pitched in the major leagues this year, gets hurt, now needs Tommy John. He's had the surgery. Now he's going through rehab. His body has gone through a lot. So, Jim, what are your thoughts about this particular decision that everyone in Sox Machine is going to have to make regarding Hendricks' club option?
It was one of the things I didn't like about the Liam Hendricks contract was like how proud Jerry Reinsdorf was of that option. He's like, we're not going to give him a guaranteed fourth year. That's crazy. This is how I'm going to do it. And this is how we got it done. Compliment me, Bob Nightingale, and our smart work. And then sure enough, it presents this really hazy situation, emotionally loaded too, with just the fact that it comes after a cancer diagnosis and everything he's been through and the kind of face he put on his cancer battle and all the good work that he did with the, you know, going around, traveling with the team, meeting cancer patients in other cities, being very proactive with just, you know, both all the people who rallied for him and then paying back once he was in the clear when he could pitch and then after he was done for the season. So, like, it's a terrible, you know, it feels really awful to say, like, yeah, we're going to buy you out. So, because I mean, that's a smart decision. That's why you do it, is like $1.5 million, even though it does add up to $15 million. In real dollars, it's less than $15 million because that $1.5 million gets a little bit cheaper every year as inflation kicks in. So, like, the real value of it is something less. I can't, yeah, I'm not an economist. I can't do the math reflexively in terms of the how much that value is diminished, but probably comes into something like $12 million or $13 million by the end of that. So, like, that's the smart move in terms of pure economics and the reason why you do that and the reason why a team tries to protect itself, even if it's annoying every year for 10 years, like factoring that $1.5 million into your plan, the way they did that with Paul Konerko and the way they're doing that with Jose Abreu right now, just like carry over money that you forget's there and you'd rather tie it up. But, you know, I think the, you know, that's probably the wise move as they go through it, but you know, part of it is, you know, if the White Sox are really paring down the payroll and they're not going to contend, and Chris Getz said, like, I've done my deep dive and I don't see a way to really turn this around. And we're going to be spending, you know, $140 million regardless, you know, a $40 million drop in our payroll. Like, it kind of makes sense. Like, give the man his money. Like, just, you know, kind of the savings are minimal for, you know, just getting it out of the way, awarding him, you know, for just being like a, you know, a positive force for non-baseball things while he couldn't be a force for baseball things. But that's kind of how I look at it. That's, you know, Jerry Reinsdorf probably didn't get rich by giving away money that he didn't have to, as we've seen. So, like, I'm really curious. Like, I don't know how this is going to happen or whether they arrange something that's kind of in between. That's a little bit more of a nod towards, yeah, we understand the human toll that you took for trying to come back. So, like, maybe it's some kind of negotiated buyout that's something in between, just making them go away, but also just paying them a little bit more upfront or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if you can do like a settlement. I'd have to do some research. And maybe those that are watching or listening to this episode, maybe you do know of an example. But that does raise a good point by Jim. Is it possible to settle a particular buyout?
They were going to do that with Steven Strasburg. the Nationals were, and then then that got hung up. The plan to have him retire because they're still negotiating it. So I know they've tried to in different guards, but
yeah, other teams have. It requires some research. But from a Hendricks point of view, listen, I negotiated this. You sign on the dotted line. I sign on the dotted line. Here's the deal. And Hendricks has mentioned it towards the end of the season in his interviews when the beat reporters were asking Hendricks, "Are you coming back?" And I thought he was very forthright, and he fully understands the situation. He thinks it's doubtful that the White Sox will pick up his $15 million option. So for Liam Hendricks, he's expecting the White Sox to not pick it up, and then he'll be paid $1.5 million over the next 10 years, and then he'll become a free agent, and then it'll be really interesting to see what teams would be willing to throw out a pillow contract and have him rehab. One team in particular that I think could do that, maybe willing to do that, is like the Los Angeles Dodgers. Obviously, they share the same spring training facility with the Chicago White Sox. Maybe pay him like $5 million for this year and pay him $15 million next year. So it looks like a two-year, $20 million contract for Hendricks. And it just helps him with rehab, and he gets a little money if he does get back in time. And if he is back to full strength, boom, the Dodgers have their late inning reliever that they've been looking for since Kenley Jensen has left him. So that's one idea that I have for Hendricks.
I think the Yankees did that too with Tommy Canley, or maybe the Dodgers did it with Canley, but like, yeah, I remember him having a similar arrangement.
Yes. So again, that's your first decision. You got to decide what you're going to be doing with Liam Hendricks. If you pick up the option, again, that adds $15 million to your budget. If you don't pick up the option, it only adds $1.5 million to your budget. Next is Tim Anderson. We have spent a lot of time in previous episodes talking about this particular option for Tim Anderson. It's either $14 million for the 2024 season, or it's a $1 million buyout. Again, Tim Anderson is coming off a career worst season. And what doesn't make matters any better is that the best available shortstop in this free agency class is Elvis Andrus, based on performance in the 2023 season. This is the worst free agent market in the history of Major League Baseball free agency, period. So really complicated situation here, Jim, but this is, I think, what will have a lot of participants on Sox Machine just like wanting to pull on their hair and just rip hair off their head is, what do I do here? Because if I don't pick it up, cool, I got $13 million to play with, but now I don't have a shortstop. And if you don't like the free agent shortstop options, like, Colson Montgomery is hitting well at the Arizona Fall League. I think he's finding his rhythm, but he's not ready yet to start on opening day. So you need some type of stopgap solution.
He's playing a bad shortstop.
Yeah, he's also playing bad shortstop. Yeah, those fears continue to mount even in the Arizona Fall League. So he may not even be a shortstop. I'm not trying to scare people during this podcast episode, but again, there's more and more people that are starting to jump on that bandwagon that Montgomery's having difficulties defensively at shortstop. I feel like this is where we're going to get a lot of trade ideas for people to try to find a shortstop, at least for the 2024 season. How are you expecting this to be played out in the offseason plan projects, Jim? I know you and I both agree that it might be best to just buy out Tim Anderson and for all parties involved to move forward and go their separate ways. But how do you think it could play out in the offseason plan project?
I think that'll be the, like, perhaps shortstop will be the most diverse pool of solutions, veterans, rookies, internal guys like Jose Rodriguez or something like that, or just stopgap veterans, trade, wild trade ideas, Romy Gonzalez randomly thrown in there, who knows, but like I can see a whole bunch of solutions for this position. Like, I think if there's a fear of buying them out, I think it might be similar to like the Kyle Schwarber arbitration decision the Cubs went to, where they non-tendered him and like the Nationals were like, sure, I'll give him a little bit more money than he was owed in arbitration. His projections were for MLB trade rumors. Because I think like he was projected for like $9 million for the Cubs. They non-tendered him. The Nationals gave him 10 or something like that. So he came out no worse for the wear. And then he goes, has a great year, gets traded to the Red Sox, then sets that up for a big 4-year deal. And like the Cubs look silly for non-tendering him. So even though it is an option versus a tender, non-tender decision, like it is a case where like you can understand like the similar, like that was foolish. Like we should have given away given how barren the shortstop market was, but there are just a lot of underlying factors here. Just the lower body issues, the, like Schwarber, he was always strong, was always going to be strong. Anderson, like his strength is like bat to ball, like BABIP, really, like getting a high batting average. And that's harder to maintain if you don't really have the ability to occasionally turn on a ball and do some damage. Like Josh Harrison was that king of medium contact. And, when the White Sox signed him, you could see like ebbs and flows, like good year, bad year, good year, bad year. Comes the White Sox, he has a bad year because it's just hard to get by trying to hit 290 when you're only going to hit like single digit homers. So I think that's what's complicating this about like trying to mine for upside and trying to figure out how Anderson produces to a level to earn that $14 million even before you factor in the durability? And when will he get hurt again, or will he be injured in a way that hampers him from tapping into like his best physical abilities to get to the level that he used to be at before? So it strikes me as like an easy buyout, but a difficult solution. And I think that's what makes it complicated. Like if the free agent market were loaded, or the White Sox had like a line of players to try like they did at second base, I think like Lenin Sosa can't quite handle shortstop. Jose Rodriguez shouldn't be counted upon to be an everyday shortstop. And like when second base is just as much as a mystery, that's what makes it hard. Like second base was easy because Tim Anderson was theoretically a fixture there. And then like when Anderson goes under, the whole middle infield sinks. So with him being gone, now you have two positions to solve and nothing looks stable and they could just be a mess behind the pitcher. So that's, I think, what is the only real pull to just stick with what you know. And it's significant. Like it's not like something you can just easily shrug away unless you have a really good idea and really have a trade idea that you really want to throw down that'll impress some people.
The Liam Hendricks decision is a grueling decision to make for a new general manager because there's a lot of emotions involved, but somebody has to make a business decision whether to pick it up or decline it. And it's deferred payments over 10 years. Here for the Tim Anderson decision, you have brand new baseball ops people in the front office, and you're going to get different opinions about Tim Anderson, I think, in that room. And it's going to be hard to come up with the consensus, and you got to figure this out like right now, right? Because you're starting the World Series. You need to continue having these conversations. I'm assuming Chris Getz has been having conversations, at least with Tim Anderson's agent, going back and forth, because if Anderson is willing to play second base, how much is he willing to do that? Like if I decline it and I offer him a 1-year contract to be our starting second baseman, would he accept that? Would he want to test free agency? And I just don't know on how the other 29 teams view Tim Anderson right now, Jim, in Major League Baseball. A couple of years ago, if he were a free agent, man, he would have cashed in like Xander Bogaerts and Javier Baez and Trey Turner, like all these mega contracts these shortstops signed when they became free agents. But he didn't. And that's unfortunately bad luck. And to make things worse, he was the worst qualified hitter in Major League Baseball, period. The worst. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what other, I don't know how other teams view him. And that's why his free agency market would be fascinating. So if you can't make a decision within 10 days or you're still uncertain, maybe it is easy to just buy out and then wait back and see and how the market views Tim Anderson. If he's still on the market, if you're a couple of weeks from away from spring training, you could always re-engage in those conversations. I know Chris Getz wasn't part of those conversations, but that's exactly on how the White Sox handled Carlos Rodon. And when he was still available, they floated $3 million. He accepted it. And boy, they really cashed in on that lottery ticket as Rodon was phenomenal in 2021. So two really tough decisions. If you pick up the option for Tim Anderson, that's $14 million added to your budget. If you decline it, it's a $1 million buyout. So if you pick up both Hendricks and Anderson, you already added $29 million to your offseason budget. Now, the other tender, non-tender, Mike Clevinger. Clevinger could decide this for you in the offseason plan project because it is a mutual option. Both sides have to agree to this. It is a $12 million contract option for the 2024 season, or if Clevinger decides to opt out, the White Sox owe him $4 million and Clevinger becomes a free agent. I think that is the route that he is going to go, Jim, even though this is a loaded free agency class. Even if Clevinger signs another $12 million deal, taking the $4 million from the White Sox and the $12 million from another team, boom, simple math, you just made $16 million. And it is all about in professional sports when you're in your 30s as a pitcher to either chase rings or make as much cash as possible. So I think that's the business decision that Mike Clevinger is going to make. We've had this conversation during our starting pitching review. From White Sox perspective, does it make sense to opt into their side of the mutual option? But again, even if you do, Clevinger has to opt in on his side. And I just don't think it's likely, Jim. Does my flow of logic here make sense? Do you agree with me from a Clevinger perspective about this mutual option?
Yeah, it's similar to the AJ Pollock situation last year to where like he only had to actually he signed for less to sign with the Mariners, but he just found a better situation with a team that he thought he fit better with. And like if he hit some incentives, he would have out earned it. So like playing more for a contender and playing more for a team that he likes in an area that he likes perhaps. And, you know, the ability to maybe earn more was ultimately enough to have him turn down the contract that he could have really settled. He could have really settled the White Sox with the problem in left field if he accepted that last year of his deal. He exercised it. So similar thing with Clevinger, where like even if he can't find 1 year and $8 million, when you look at like the pitchers who signed for $8 million last year, like he should be able to find something along those lines. Like even if he has to sign for like $7 million, and he could probably figure out like a incentive deal to where like if he hits 100 innings or if he hits 12 starts, then all of a sudden he's earning like an extra $1 million. And then like that's a case where, yeah, and then every 20 innings or every whatever, you're earning more and more. And so like one way or another, he should be able to beat $8 million, find a situation that's not a sinking ship. And like the White Sox will want to trade him if they do exercise that option, most likely, whether it's during the winter or whether it's during the season. So like he may as well pick where he wants to go if he's going to earn that money. The question I have with the White Sox is like, does it make sense that since they have to pay him $4 million anyway, if they sense like Clevinger is going to accept, like, do they just decline it and say like, we're going to cut the ties ourselves? Like, you know, you're not breaking up with me, I'm breaking up with you. It's kind of like a signal of like, mistakes were made in terms of the vetting process last time or how they, went about, their due diligence. So like, that's what I'm kind of curious about, the timing more than the outcome.
When I saw the Milwaukee Bucks make that big trade with Portland for Damian Lillard, I immediately went on Game Time to see when they were playing the Chicago Bulls. Saw it was on November 30th, and Game Time had great seats in the 300 level right at center court in the United Center. Great tickets at a great price. I couldn't pass up the opportunity. Buying tickets shouldn't be stressful. Use Game Time to purchase your tickets. Game Time is the fast and easy way to buy tickets for sports, music, comedy, and theater near you. They've got killer deals on last minute tickets, and their best price guarantee helps eliminate stressing over tickets. If you find tickets in the same section and even row for less money, Game Time will credit you 110% of the difference. That's why Game Time is the fastest growing ticketing app in the country. Download the Game Time app, create your account, and get $20 off your first purchase using our promo code SOXMACHINE. Terms and conditions apply. Again, create an account and use our promo code SOXMACHINE for $20 off your first ticket purchase. Game Time. Last minute tickets, lowest prices, guaranteed.
The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way. And that's with Babbel. Be a better you in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts and help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's designed by real people for real conversations, and their tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription at babbel.com/bluewire. That's 60% off at babbel.com/bluewire, spelled BABBEL.com/bluewire. Rules and restrictions apply.
I don't know what the new front office, if they're going to be willing to admit like mistakes were made. But again, if the White Sox don't opt in on their side, they got some work to do on the starting pitching front. And I do think you're right. Like, even if Clevinger does sign like a $10 million deal, from a business decision perspective, it just, unless Mike Clevinger absolutely loves working with Ethan Katz and he absolutely loves Chicago and he absolutely loves pitching for the Chicago White Sox, I just don't see him opting in on his side of the $12 million. So yeah, for those participating, go ahead.
Well, it's like the one thing catch is like, did the events of the last winter hurt his market going into this? Like, you know, obviously the investigation, he was the league did not find a reason to issue discipline. So like, you know, it's theoretically like the White Sox got the worst of it in terms of like signing the public blowback, all of the things that they couldn't talk about and just had to, and you know, wait and experience. And like, you know, another team signing Clevinger should say like, you know, well, yeah, it's, you know, that happened last year with the White Sox and previously with the Padres, and you know, the league investigated, and we feel like their investigation, you know, and the way he conducted himself afterwards made us feel confident in this 1 year contract. So like, I could see it being that way, but also like sometimes like guys have a hard time finding jobs after something like that. So like I could see where the market takes a while for him to play out, and just like, maybe it's a case of just another year putting it behind him might be a smarter play. Like that's the one catch I can see as to why Clevinger might accept it. If his agent's saying, well, you know, sometimes you need a little bit more time to put something in the rearview mirror. So fans of other teams and other, you know, general managers and such just kind of forget about it, or at least have something more to point to in terms of why they think that this guy is a sound investment.
From that perspective, that would be Clevinger admitting some fault, and he has not done that during this entire process.
Yep.
So I your logic makes sense, Jim. I don't see that happening or unfolding this particular situation. So I guess I'll make the executive decision for those that are listening for you guys. Boom, $4 million to Mike Clevinger. So you'd save $8 million from the $12 million, but you got some work to do on the starting pitching front. So those are the three players that have upcoming club options or mutual options that you have to make decisions for. The next step is the arbitration eligible players. For those that are watching on YouTube, I have made this slide and I have strategically placed certain players together, grouped them up. So I'll start with most likely to be picked up to least likely to be picked up. Dylan Cease, and we're using these totals from MLB Trade Rumors. His estimated number is $8.8 million. Michael Kopech estimated it's $3.6 million. Andrew Vaughn is estimated at $3.7 million. Tuki Toussaint is at $1.7 million. And Garrett Crochet, his first year of arbitration at $900,000. These are the three that I don't think it's likely they're going to be tendered contracts. Matt Foster at $740,000, but I could see the White Sox non-tendering and then inviting Foster to a spring training invite as he recovers from significant injury. Clint Frazier at $900,000, and even though it does break my heart for the White Sox to break up, what would this be, the fourth time the White Sox broke up with Trace Thompson?
Yeah.
Thompson has a estimated arbitration number at $1.7 million. So we got this comment from our friend Beefloaf on YouTube. Pick up Trace Thompson, you coward. No, I will be a coward. I will not be picking up Trace Thompson's option. So out of eight players, I think five. The White Sox will pick up five contracts here, Jim.
Yeah, I think maybe Tuki Toussaint is the one who, yeah, and these are MLB Trade Rumors projections. So some guys end up on the high side, some guys end up on the low side, and sometimes the figures individually can fluctuate, sometimes outside of a standard deviation, but ultimately like the net sum usually is in the neighborhood. So even if I think it's more of an exercise, it's valuable for like figuring out how much of your payroll is dedicated towards arbitration eligible players versus like how much is one person going to make. But in this case, like Toussaint, like 1.7 feels like fair for what he provided, both starting and relieving. Like, but I could see if his number came in at like 2.3, maybe the White Sox think that's too much. Whereas if it, you know, comes in at like 1.1, maybe it's something different to where like White Sox is like obvious no brainer and he's going to be making less than anybody thought. The one I think would be exceptionally bold is like Michael Kopech if they just said no thanks. But I think probably 1 year too early to be like, and given how little other pitching they have, like maybe in another year, in another situation, they might say like, now we're good. We could use that $3.6 million elsewhere, especially since like his trade value is next to nothing right now. But that's the one that jumped out to me in terms of other years. I could make a stronger case for that. Trace Thompson, like, it seemed like his value to the White Sox was showing how much they hated Oscar Colas. Like, because, like, how poorly he played. Like, Kolas could have done what Thompson did, the plate, striking out 40 times in 92 plate appearances. So, like, he offered nothing. Like, he was decent in the field, but, you know, was basically nothing at the plate. But, like, they just kept running him out there because, like, it was just more or less making a point, saying, like, no, we don't want you here. This is how little we want you here, is that we're bringing in Trace Thompson and paying him to strike out every other at bat, and we consider that a better experience. So if they brought him back, that would really be like just sending a message, really burying him in the death chart, and say like, yep, this is what you've done to yourself, and this is how firmly entrenched in the doghouse you are.
Yikes. I hope you're wrong, Jim. It does happen.
It's just like they would find some other guy, I imagine. Some, you know, that'd be like a non-roster invitee who would come in, like basically like Clint Frazier, I think, would be that sort of guy, like the equivalent of that, who will be non-tendered by somebody else.
All right. So those are your pending free agents, pick up the club options, mutual options, the arbitration eligible players. So after you have that sorted out and you have the carryovers that you can look up on COTS contracts, and Jim will have that link for you guys on SoxMachine.com in the offseason plan project template, so you can see what the numbers are. SpotTrack is also a great resource as well to look up on what the payroll salary number, that's the key, not the luxury tax salary. We're talking about payroll salary here. What the payroll salary number is going to be. To add,
never have to worry about
budget.
The luxury tax.
Never have to worry about the luxury tax. No. So with that being said, it is now time to unveil your budget for this offseason plan project. And it's going to be $185 million. I view this number to be very fair. We talked about it off screen in conversations back and forth, Jim. And I think your logic makes sense. Listen, if Jerry Reinsdorf really does want to contend in the American League Central, despite the drop in attendance and despite the television ratings taking a hit, if this is really like the last hurrah as an 87-year-old baseball owner, he really can't cut budget at this time.
Right. Previously, you know, like I said, I set the budget at $190 million. And like you said, with Jerry Reinsdorf, like, if you want to push, you have to end up spending in a similar neighborhood. And so like $185 million, I think, gives people the option. Even if you think that number is grossly inflated or optimistic based on the plunging attendance and in TV ratings. But like, hey, you know, like if he didn't want to hire the reanimated corpse of Branch Rickey, he went with Chris Getz because he wanted turnaround quickly. So like, this is more or less me putting his money where his mouth was. The question for the GMs who do this exercise is, do you think it's worth spending all that money? It might not be. Like, it might be spending it in vain. You might not get solutions. You might block guys. You might have to, you know, you might end up in an Andrew Benintendi situation where you overpay for somebody who's not going to be able to contribute his first couple years of a free agent contract for a team that's going to get anywhere. So like, that's, I think there's a little bit of discretion on the part of somebody doing the offseason plan project. And I think for me, like, what I'm curious to see is whether people, you know, really try to go all out to pursue like 85 wins, like the Diamondbacks model of trying to sneak into that third wildcard spot, or the AL Central, whichever one's closer, because sometimes you never quite know when comes right to win thresholds. I could see, you know, gunning for that and trying to come up with some creative solutions, but I could see other people saying like, yeah, I've tried to get there and I just don't see a comprehensive team doing that. I'm going to focus on like setting my team up better for 2025, trying to figure out how to at least get one facet of this team on solid ground, because we've talked about it. What does this team do well? It's hard to say if they do anything well. At one point, it was starting pitching. Like, they had the best five-man rotation in the AL Central. that kind of blew up on them in a hurry last year, and then they were left with nothing. So like if you're a GM and you're just looking for what constitutes progress, like that's a pretty easy way to look at it, is trying to get your team to do something better, to do something that's an actual strength, to do something that might last the whole season. And even if that results in a team that wins 70 games or 75, like that might be enough to where like you feel better about 2025 when Colson Montgomery and Brian Ramos and other prospects are a bigger part of the picture. So that's why I think there's a little bit of a fork in the road here. And I think that's why Chris Getz has been, he went from hitting the ground running and knowing the team inside and out and knowing exactly what he has to do to being somebody's like, oh, you know, I got to do a deeper dive and see what's really here now that Jerry Reinsdorf is not in the same room that I am. And I don't have to, I can contradict him a little bit and say that quick turnaround might not happen. So that's what I think is the more, you know, even if it's not as fun of a project and figuring out like how to get the best possible team on the field, I think there are probably more nuanced, complicated, maybe enlightening, philosophical conversations to be had in terms of what do you want this team to be and what's the first step in getting there.
And there's a lot of chatter right now as we are streaming live on youtube.com/Sox Machine about the budget. Already some pushback. People think it's too high. There's no way the White Sox would maintain that. So I have generated a rough draft, and I've also created a Google sheet as well, a very handy template that you could add players and what you think the salary, what you would sign that player to be, and it adds up the budget for you. And deciding to not pick up the options and Liam Hendricks, Tim Anderson, and then Mike Clevinger opting out, taking the carryovers from last year, as far as like with the bullpen and having a bench of like Corey Lee, Zach Remillard, and Gavin Sheets, needing to find a starting catcher, starting second baseman and shortstop, a starting right fielder, three starting pitchers, and whoever to be the eighth guy in the bullpen. Maybe you don't spend any money, just throw a random person in there. But with all that laundry list, again, catcher, second base, shortstop, right field, three starting pitchers, I'm already at $109.6 million. So if you restrict yourself to $150 million, for example, you got $40 million to find three starting pitchers. You can't do it. In free agency, you can't do it. Nick Nastrini will be in your starting rotation. And I already see in the comments section as well, when you're starting to do the math, like how in the world do you trade for Salvador Perez if you don't have a $185 million budget? You don't. You can't trade for Salvador Perez because you just don't.
I said it too high. Never mind. 130.
Cut it. Slash it.
Yeah.
So even with this, like if you follow along and you have a similar rough draft like I do, at least with the plan, you got $75 million to work with to find three starting pitchers, a catcher, a new middle infielder, and right field. Like, I'm not going to lie with you guys. Like, I'm already starting on my rough draft. This is an arduous task in trying to build a team that could bounce back and win in 2024, or at least pretend that they could challenge the Minnesota Twins for the American League Central. It is not easy. It requires a lot of bounce back. And it requires a lot of free agent signings and taking risks on guys on 1 to 2 year contracts so you don't saddle yourself with bad contracts going to 2025, because a lot of money does fall off the books for the White Sox, or at least the possibility of a lot of money could fall off the books for the Chicago White Sox. So you could have more money to spend, or that is when Jerry Reinsdorf does say, forget it, we ran our course. Budget of 2025 is $125 million, and then I'm not even sure on how you can build a 26-man team. You may have to call up the Savannah Bananas to help you out, fill out the rest of the roster. But, I mean, it's tough. I mean, this is the laundry list we talked about in the review podcast episodes. Again, a new middle infield, someone to start a catcher, someone to figure out right field, and the most pressing and the most money-consuming is the starting pitching. Whether you find free agents or you'd be like, Josh, I want to trade for starting pitchers, man, look at the what has been traded at the deadline and in the offseason, it requires a great deal of prospect cost. So the White Sox don't have a lot of prospects that they want to deal. They just acquired a bunch at the deadline. So I'm assuming they want to keep some of these guys around to see if they could help themselves out for this upcoming season. It's a delicate balance. And again, I find this particular offseason plan project to be one of the most difficult tasks that we've had with this project since we brought it over in 2018 from Southside Sox Gym. This is where it's difficult. Like $75 million, hey, that's a lot of money. I could be really creative. Maybe you go after a big free agent, or maybe you do like the idea of acquiring Salvador Perez. But again, it's new middle infielder, catcher, right fielder. So that's what, four position players you got to find, and three starting pitchers. Seven new players for $75 million. That's going to be tough.
Well, Clutch Hattrick, thanks for the super tip here, saying, how about the Rule 5 draft? I could see them like going round after round. Round after round, picking guys, just filling out the roster. But yeah, it's
not a bad idea when it comes to finding that eighth guy in the bullpen, though. If there is somebody that throws 97 in AAA, sure. We heard some good things about Jordan Leisure. The White Sox acquired him from the mid-year deals. Maybe they give him a shot. I mean, I don't want the White Sox to spend any money on the bullpen, but I don't hate the idea. Like, the Rule 5 draft is great in finding relievers.
Yeah. I think, thinking about Michael Kopech and thinking about, like, how little trade value he has, like, part of the White Sox job, I think, in terms of filling out the rotation, might be looking for other teams' Michael Kopechs and saying, like, which is a guy who, like, has shown the ability to start, looks like he's on the way out. Team might not want him around. Team might be happy to free up the salary or get somebody, like, low-level interesting in return to them, and maybe the White Sox can shape him into something. I think that's part of the reason why Brian Bannister is aboard, because the Giants were really good at stitching together rotations that had some name brand talent, but also got by with like middle of the road free agents and guys who get 1 year and 2 year deals. So I think that's part of the reason why he's around, is to have a rotation that's better or greater than the sum of its parts. So I'm looking forward to seeing what he does in that regard and like who might come aboard. It's nice to have somebody in this organization to where you can say, like, yeah, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. I'll see whether this pans out. Like, yeah, numbers aren't great and he's not throwing strikes, but like he's done it elsewhere. So let's see what he does here. You know, it's another case where like maybe the White Sox are getting him too late and the Giants were, not hell bent on keeping him for a reason, but his track record is probably the best individual track record of any White Sox front office member or member of the coaching staff. So I'm going to lean on that and say like, here's a little pleasant bit of relief to where like you don't have to second guess so hard. You can say like, yeah, you can, trust but verify, or, keep an open mind, but I'm looking forward to being like, yeah, let's see what he does. Let's build up a data set for whether Brian Bannister's ideas for the White Sox are any good, whether Ethan Katz can implement them and see them through. And at least it gives you a pleasant bit of, I don't know, which I think is better than like, in most cases,
dealt
like
with the
like,
last 10 years. Yeah.
Rick Hahn signs an Adam Eaton, you're just like, nah, this isn't gonna work.
Our first guesses were pretty spot on. in recent years, when it came to the offseason, that is what's going to be intriguing, especially when we do other media appearances as well. When people ask, what do you think the White Sox are going to do? I don't know. We don't know. We're dealing with a brand new front office for the first time in a decade, maybe even two decades, depending on just how much control Kenny Williams had during the Rick Hahn tenure, especially in the rebuild part, or at least leaving the rebuild and try to go into contending, depending on who you speak with. Yeah, it's all new ground and all new ideas. So that is also the other exciting thing about this offseason plan project. In past years, definitely there were bad ideas. But there's only one bad idea for this upcoming offseason pilot project, and that is trying to orchestrate a trade with Kansas City for Salvador Perez. Other than that, there are no bad ideas for the offseason plan project.
do not enable Pedro Grifol. Make him earn it.
Right. The team's got to win, and then you could add him in the mid-season. Maybe. But when it comes to offseason ideas, I know we mentioned a lot of popular names in last year's offseason plan project. Are there any particular targets, Jim, that you are intrigued by and you're curious to see what other people feel like on Sox Machine as a possible offseason target for the White Sox?
I think we talked about like the Brian Bannister connections in free agency with the Giants, like Alex Wood is one. Jacob Junis is another. Like, without trying to put my thumb on the scale too much in terms of like, you know, influencing ideas too much, not like, yeah, not to flatter myself, but just I part of the reason I enjoy the offseason plan project so much is like people having ideas that I wouldn't even thought of. Like, sometimes they're good, sometimes they're not, but sometimes the ideas that I don't think are good turn out to be like, oh, that wasn't so bad after all. So that's why I always keep an open mind and just, you know, I try to offer, you know, only positive feedback versus like, oh, that's not going to happen. You mind, like, even if it's like a ridiculous plan, like there might be one good idea in there. And so like, that's what I kind of mind for. But I think like that's when thinking about Bannister and thinking about, like, as you mentioned, Chamania being used in a kind of a hybrid role. Same thing with Ross Stripling when they brought him aboard. Like, with all of these starts available, like the White Sox do have a lot of opportunities to experiment with like part-time starters or openers or bulk pitchers. So like guys who might only throw 100 innings, like the White Sox can use those guys because even if it's not your plan A or plan B for like an ideal starter who takes the ball every 5 or 6 days, you still need pitchers after that. Like, that's how pitching starved they are up top, is like, if you can throw 100 innings and maintain health for 5 of 6 months, you can find a role on this team, which is why Touki Toussaint goes from being like somebody who is a scrap heap pickup and probably a non-tender when they acquired him to being like a pretty easy tender as long as the projection is anywhere in the neighborhood. So that's, I think, there are a lot of ways to go about solving the pitching problem, both with free agency trades and pitchers who might be spot starters, but you might be able to use them in creative ways. I guess what I'm not looking forward to in terms of what I dread on everybody's behalf is the middle infield, because the White Sox have to solve both positions. It's no longer just second base. The it's spread. It's broken contain.
Yeah. My rough draft is hilarious when it comes to the middle infield. Like, I maybe have built the worst $180 million team in baseball history. Like, just awful. Now, we have some ideas coming trickling in on our YouTube comments. Trey put in his targets are Eduardo Rodriguez, Alex Wood, and Mitch Garver. Two of these, I think, are realistic. Eduardo Rodriguez, I don't think, is leaving Detroit. And because he has that no trade clause, or he's got to give permission to Detroit to activate a trade. And he wasn't willing to do that for Los Angeles Dodgers for personal reasons. Sounds like he does not want to move his family right now.
Well, so John Heyman said he's going to opt out.
He's going to opt out.
Yeah. That's what John Heyman said. So whether that's like leverage to try to get like a year extension, which sometimes you see, when it comes to players who like might be able to use that to like get Detroit to add on another year at the same salary, like that's possible. And so maybe he doesn't actually leave Detroit, even if he is considering opting out, but that's one possibility.
Oh, that's fascinating. I did not know about that, but then that just makes it, oh, okay. That makes the whole not taking the deal to the Dodgers and try to pitch in the playoffs. Okay. Whatever. Okay. That's interesting. All right. So that's a big surprise. Okay, Trey. So yeah, not a bad idea. There you go. You got two starting pitchers and a catcher.
And at different price points too. Like, I can see like one, you know, one starter who's a significant investment and then one who might be a 1-year deal. Like, I could see that kind of being the mix the White Sox try to go with.
Yeah, because like Wood, I think he signed for his deal's $12.5 million. So maybe if you give him $12 million to come pitch for the White Sox, but promise him that he's a starter more times than out of the bullpen. Maybe that convinces him. Here's one idea that I have, and I'm wondering how many people are going to do it, and I would do it just for the vibes, man. A reunion of Lucas Giolito and Jack Flaherty, Jim. I need you to be on my side on this. I need you to be on the boat with me. Let's make this happen. Harvard, Westlake, High. Let's bring it all back. Cats, Flaherty, Giolito, they will resurrect the starting pitching staff and lead it to glory.
It's like Saved by the Bell, the college years, or like the reunion show, yeah, which I guess would make like Ethan Katz, Mr. Belding. Yeah. I mean, like Jack Flaherty be a case of just like, yeah, why not? Lucas Giolito, yeah, like if he wants to have like a pillow contract because he didn't quite set himself up well enough to get the multi-year deal he wants, like, and he's comfortable working with Katz and likes what Bannister has to say, maybe. Like, it seemed like as much as the White Sox were a real clown show, I guess it'd be a circus, but circus sounds too dignified for what the White Sox were. There are other things besides clowns at the surface, whereas the White Sox, I'm not quite sure. But I could see him being like, yeah, I'm comfortable there. Like, I liked being there. And so, like, may as well. You know, if I'm going to bounce back anywhere, it may as well be there if I'm only planning on being there 3 or 4 months anyway. But I could also see it being a remnant of what happened before. Like, the discussion with Tim Anderson is just like, do you want to turn the page on the rebuild and just the weird leadership structure that did or didn't exist or was tangled or one-sided and that the pitchers had something and the position players didn't? Like, do you just want to turn the page on that entirely and not have anybody come in with like previously held gravitas and you know, leadership that might not have been great? I'm not saying Giolito was that guy, just that is all, you know, everybody is part of it to some degree. Like, that's what I don't quite know about these reunions, but I do like the idea of like Giolito on a short deal. Sure. You got to get those starts from somewhere. Jack Flaherty, like, yeah, he's the kind of bounce back candidate they'd have to try to find. And like, if he's looking for a 1 year deal and a guy like him might want to take a deal with a non-contender just because like by the end of the year, like he might be pitching for a contender. Like, he figures if I play my cards right, I'll be back on the Orioles. Like, that might be like the path he sees, as long as the White Sox don't structure the contract to have like a hefty buyout that kills his trade value, because like all of a sudden the White Sox paid for the cheap parts and the team that's trading for him has to pay for like the lump sum at the end.
Yeah. I think my strategy with my offseason plan project is a lot of 1-2 year deals, really short term type of contracts, maybe multiple years with Mitch Garver, 'cause I'm just not very high on Corey Lee or Carlos Perez. And Garver proved that even though he's not behind the plate because the Texas Rangers like Jonah Highmore defensively, Garver is still a very good DH option. Like, he is a good bat to have in the lineup. So he's one of my top targets, Trey. So I'm with you on the Mitch Garver, and I don't think signing Alex Witt is a bad idea to be helping out on the back of the rotation. You still got to find 2 more starting pitchers. Well, he did have Eduardo Rodriguez, so maybe that's a possibility. You still got to find another starting pitcher, Trey. So that's the whole thing with this offseason plan project and how tough it is, again, based unless on my rough draft.
Yeah, unless you really want to stick with Michael Kopech. Like, that's the one case of just like, yeah, his knee was still a problem. Brian Bannister is going to help him out. Like, that's whether the White Sox have suckered us into believing in Michael Kopech for 1 year too long by bringing in Brian Bannister, I think that will be one of his biggest tests early, is like a reality check for whether Kopech can actually start. And if Brian Bannister can figure it out, who can?
Yeah, I think he'll help him figure it out in the bullpen. That's my plan right now for Michael Kopech. But again, this all starts Friday morning, October 27th on SoxMachine.com. Jim will have the template for you. You can copy and paste it. Use Google Word or Microsoft Word, whatever you want to use. Fill it out. Explain your strategy, your moves, post it on SoxMachine.com and let people review it, and they will definitely chime in and how they feel about your offseason plan in the comment section. Again, there's only one bad idea out there. And maybe you like that bad idea and you want to defend that bad idea. You go right ahead. And it's again, just helps encourage a lot of conversation, and it's a very fun exercise on SoxMachine.com. I can't wait to see everyone's plans, Jim. And I'm excited to get going.
Yeah, I always like feel like Paul Hollywood at this point, like just the technical challenge, issuing the time limit, the recipe list, and a vague piece of advice, and then leaving the tent. So like, yeah,
look for
I
flavor.
Always enjoy this part. Yes.
Yeah, you want to add
no
flavor.
Soggy bottoms here.
Well, that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast as we officially kick off the off-season plan project. Thank you to all those that watched the live stream on our YouTube page at youtube.com/Sox Machine. If you did watch the video, please subscribe to our channel. We would greatly appreciate it as we'll continue to upload videos all off-season long on our YouTube channel. And of course, with Sox Machine Live, we always take the audio from the video and upload it into our podcast feed, so that works better for your schedule and mobility. To listen to us instead of watch us, you can subscribe to the Sox Machine Podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Podcasts, also Google and Amazon Music. We are there as well. If you are on social media, we're also on social media as well. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky, whatever is out there, at Sox Machine. You can also follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. If you enjoy our work and you want more, you can get more by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/SoxMachine, where our Patreon supporters get exclusive content. They also get ad-free versions of both the podcast and website. And coming early November, we are going to be having a town hall with our Patreon supporters to share some of our plans for the upcoming 2024 calendar year at Sox Machine, kind of unveiling and pulling back the curtain so they can see what's happening in the background that Jim and I are working on for next year and even this upcoming off season. So if you're, again, if you like our work and you want to help support us, you could definitely do that at patreon.com/Sox Machine. Sox Machine Live is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for watching and listening.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers. The trusted choice recommended by leading experts, with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.